Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Ann Arbor District Library. My name is Tim Grimes. I'm the Manager of Community Relations and Marketing here at the Library. It is a beautiful February afternoon, and I want to thank you for spending it here with us in this wonderful program. This is one of many events that we have here at the Library. You can find out more about our events at aadl.org or by grabbing our brochures in the back. This is also a special event because we're connecting it with Ann Arbor Ypsilanti Reads. We hold Ann Arbor Ypsilanti Reads each year. It's a community initiative to get people talking and reading and discussing a common book and a common theme. The book this year is The Living Great Lakes by Jerry Dennis, and the theme this year is Michigan. And so we have a lot of programs about Michigan. Our final program is going to be this Thursday. It's Green Industry and the Future of Michigan. I think that'll be a wonderful event, Thursday night here at 7. But today's program centers on a special part of Michigan, Ann Arbor. It's co-sponsored by the Washtenaw County Historical Society. And here from the society is Ralph Beebe.
Well, we're getting a nice break from the Olympics. Why not? I'm Ralph Beebe. I'm program chair for the Historical Society and the Museum on Main Street. Many of you know about that. We have two more programs in the series this year, February, March, and April. This is the February one. In March, our speaker will be the restoration of 1526 Pontiac Trail, and the program will be held at the Ypsilanti District Library. And then the final meeting for the year is on April 18th, 90 years, Lake Michigan Crossings. And that will be at the Traverwood, the Ann Arbor District Library Traverwood branch. And I'm very grateful to the Library Association and the District Library for permitting us to use and have a coordinated meeting with them. We've done this several years now, and it's wonderful because the museum space is so limited. And if there's an exhibit, there's just not enough room there to have programs. So we're filling up this. I think it's standing room only almost, right? The next exhibit, the museum does not have an exhibit on right now. They are working on installing a new exhibit that will open on March 6th and run through June 20th. And it will be called Use It or Lose It. Isn't that right? Use It or Lose It. And it'll having to do with preservation of buildings and the problems involved. That's why the speaker speaker that we have in March will be that the restoration of that house on 1526 Pontiac Trail. But to get to today's program, thank you all for coming. The title of the show you can see here: Whiston Stevens and Kingsbury Marzolf. They will be doing this program as a Mutt and Jeff combination, the two of them tossing this program back and forth between them. And so it should be a lively program. So I'll turn the program over to Kingsbury and Whiston. Thank you.
Actually, we do Laurel and Hardy, not Mutt.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, right. We've been talking about doing it for years, but we've never done it, Ollie. When are we going to do it?
We do it every 17 years until we get it right.
Right. Tell them about the book before we start.
Yes. Actually, this program was Kingsbury's idea, I think, in the first place, back in 1993.
1890, yes, right.
I knew it was a previous century. But he had been copying the photographs from this wonderful book called Artwork of Washtenaw County, using the Bentley Library's files of the photos. I think the Bentley Library copy of the work is disassembled. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at it for a long time.
No, I don't. I think the one here was, you reported in your message that the one here has been taken apart.
Yeah, you mean that you worked from a solid copy?
Yeah, I worked from a book.
Oh, because when I looked at the Bentley photos years and years ago, they had some loose ones. I didn't realize they had a book, too. It doesn't matter. We're kind of maundering here. But the point is that this book came out in 1893. It was put together by an outfit in Chicago, which I think was capitalizing on an interest in American architecture and history that had been stimulated a bit by the Chicago World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition of the 400th anniversary of the discovery of the New World by Columbus. And that fair was held in Chicago, the great white city on the lake, it was called, and brought a lot of people into that area. Anyway, this company started to put out books for various municipalities around the country, and we don't know exactly how it was done, but it was probably some kind of a missionary effort where they would send out an agent to talk to the prominent citizens of a community and persuade them to invest in the work, or at least to promise to purchase a certain number of copies of the finished work. And it turns out, if you Google artwork of that phrase on the internet, you can come up with 64 different titles that this company put out in a period of about 7 or 8 years. I think the last one was in 1898. And one of them, one of the early ones, happened to be the artwork of Washtenaw County. So in 1993, it seemed a logical thing to do, when we had these photographs, to put them together with commentary and present it as a program to the Washtenaw County Historical Society. We did it at the Bentley Historical Library on that occasion. And if you were there then, you don't have to stay now, because it's the same pictures.
You've seen it all.
Yeah, we do this every 17 years, as I say, until we get it right.
Right.
Yeah, and
I think it's interesting. You told them that these, or me, that these were put out in 12 segments, so that they came out apparently every month. You got a group of these, and then you could put together your own book.
I think those are called fascicles.
Oh, good.
You take the fascicles and you bind them at the end. Isn't that the word fascism related to that?
Yeah, I guess it does, doesn't it? Just pulling together or something. It's interesting, because within each of these 12 parts, there's no order or any logic. By the way, Ypsilanti is in there, and so is Milan and Dexter, and I think maybe Chelsea and some other places, and a few sort of landscapes and rivers, but otherwise they are all in certain small communities, with Ann Arbor not surprisingly getting the most of these pictures. And there also is no particular order in any kind of chronology. The buildings are just a mix in the book, and so that means you can take these and do anything you want with them. And we've put these together to form a kind of tour through the city. I first wanted to show you what is not in the book. These are a couple of examples of our very nice classical revival houses in Ann Arbor, and they are not in there. And maybe as we go on, we could figure out why, but it's possible that they thought these were too old-fashioned. Can you imagine somebody in 1893 saying, oh, we don't want that old-fashioned classical revival stuff. We're going to do this up-to-date stuff we're doing now, right? And the fact is that of the pictures that we're going to show you, the earliest date on any building in it that we can identify its date for is 1860. So that means they really stuck to the last 33 years in putting this together. This is a view from up on Cedar Bend Drive, back when you could see down over the city. And now the trees are all grown up, so you don't get such a view. But it's fun to see the city as it was then.
The University Hospitals on Catherine Street. There was a row of about five buildings there eventually, and you can see some of the early ones there at the far left.
Well, just to show you what you see now, you see that. And so it's not much of a place to look down on the city anymore. Remember, that's the street that starts up off of Broadway and then works its way as a path now down to, is it Geddes, where there's another piece of it? Fuller, that's right. And there's some houses down there, but in between, I guess you can still walk through there, but you can't drive through it. Anyway, that's, remember this, folks? This, if you go up on Wilt Street, or Wilt Street, maybe it is, that's where this picture was taken, I think, years ago. But I went up there, and by golly, if you try to get through the underbrush and trees to take a picture, you would plummet 25 feet down onto the track. So I gave it up.
What you have here is a panorama of Argo Pond, the lower end of Argo Pond that's been such a subject of controversy the past year. This is the Argo Dam down here, the old version of it. And sweeping across the center of the picture here is the Toledo and Ann Arbor and North Michigan Railroad. That was an early name for what is now the Ann Arbor Railroad. It went into bankruptcy in the 1890s, and right after these pictures were taken. And the name was changed during bankruptcy simply to the Ann Arbor Railroad. But it's interesting that we have here examples of two of the early bridge structures on the railroad. This stuff over here is the original wooden riprap that supported the original trestle that was designed by Charles Ezra Green, professor of civil engineering at the University of Michigan. And that stood there for about 10 years, starting in 1881. And then it was replaced in 1891 or 92 by this trestle that you see here in 1893, which was made of steel. But the owner of the railroad, a man named James M. Ashley, for whom Ashley Street in Ann Arbor was named, he was originally from Toledo. He'd been a congressman and was building the railroad on a shoestring. And although he realized that it was important and it was time to replace the wooden trestle with a steel one, he skimped on the recipe. He didn't use as much steel as his new engineer, Henry Riggs, had recommended, with the disastrous result in January of 1904, the collapse of this trestle under an increasingly heavy load of freight. And in 1904, of course, it had to be rebuilt, and that's the trestle that's still there now. It's been there for 106 years. Who knows, you know, how many months it has to go.
Was there a train? Whiston, was there a train on it when it collapsed?
There was a train on it when it collapsed, yes. Once I was at a meeting of the Historical Society, and the late Ray Spokes was present, and he recalled the collapse. I guess we were showing pictures of old Ann Arbor then. And he remembered as a lad going out in 1904 on the ice in January of 1904. He'd read or heard somewhere that there was one of those freight cars on the ice loaded with Beeman's Pepsin gum. Which he went out there and somehow was able to sneak out, I don't know, several hundred pounds of Beeman's Pepsin gum, which was soaking wet, of course. And he took it up to his mother's or grandmother's house on High Street, overlooking the river, and says he dried it in her oven over the weekend and then sold it at the Jones School. Two packs for a nickel or something like that. That was his first experience in capitalism.
All right. There, Dr. Chase's steam printing house. We're going down Main Street, sort of from north to south, starting with that trestle. And this is at Miller's.
Bracketed Italianate.
Yeah, and a beautiful one with all of the. Cornice work on it, but that's gone, unfortunately.
Yeah, that was the building that Dr. Chase erected in segments. The original part was the part right at the left, just the one third there at the left on the corner. To publish his newspaper called the Peninsular Courier and Family Visitant, one of about a half a dozen weekly newspapers in Ann Arbor in the 1860s, so in 1868, he erected that part, or 64 there, don't you? I guess it was 68 that the second part came. That was the other two-thirds. And he put out a book of recipes, which also included household remedies, very important at a time when doctors were far from the far-flung farms of the Midwest, and one needed to do one's own doctoring, and having Dr. Chase's book was an essential part of this. It became the national bestseller. Unfortunately, Dr. Chase was something of a hypochondriac, and he was making all this money. He'd tripled the size of his building. In 1869, when it was finished, he said, "Let's have a party." He invited all the hoi polloi of Ann Arbor to come down and see his building and pay him his dues, and then announced that he was going to sell everything he owned and leave town and move to Minnesota. Minnesota being far more salubrious climate, I guess, in his his rather bewildered imagination. And he made a deal with a man named Rice Beale of Ann Arbor. Beale Avenue commemorates the name of Rice Beale's son, Junius, who was a regent of the university for many years. And then Beale agreed, without a whole lot of arm twisting, to take the building off of Dr. Chase's hands and the newspaper, which was going great guns, and also the book, rights to all future publications of anything under the name of Dr. Chase, and the inventory in the building, and a few other goodies. And Dr. Chase got some money, we don't know how much, and a rundown hotel in a suburb of Minneapolis, which is so obscure I don't even remember the name of the town. And he went off there to manage this hotel. Said later that it was a great experience, but he came back to Ann Arbor after only a year or two with his tail between his legs. He found out that his health was not that bad that he had to spend his time in Minnesota. At least one winter was enough to cure him. And then he came back to town and tried to start the business again. He tried to put a new book together. And he started a new newspaper with other investors. And Beale said, "Wait a minute, we had a deal." And he took Chase to court. The suit quickly went all the way up to the Supreme Court of Michigan, and Dr. Chase lost. He had to give the rights to the second volume of recipes to Mr. Beale. He had to sell his interest in the newspaper, or Beale would have been able to put it out of business, and his fellow investors would have lost their shirts. So this was a grinding experience for Dr. Chase, but we still have this building. Unfortunately, sans the cornice, and sans that interesting archway.
But I think it was Johnson, Johnson & Roy that first started fixing up this building, and for a while had their office in it.
Yeah.
I recall, from the 1970s.
And then Dobson McComber Insurance was in there for quite a while.
So it's nice we still have it, at least, doesn't it?
Be nice if somebody put the cornice back on.
Yes.
Hint, hint.
Yeah, right. This is one of my favorites. If this had still been here when I was in preservation stuff, I would have, you know, been marching next to that to save it. I think it's a great building. But I've never heard anything about who designed it. Clearly somebody must have designed this thing.
Or during a nightmare one night.
Right.
Probably had too many Welsh rarebits the night before.
But see, it lasted till 1935, which means that I hadn't quite made it here yet. I was only six at that time, so. But
it was 8 years before I was born, so I won't take the blame either.
Anyway,
it's called the Beale Block. We should mention that.
The Beale Block?
Yeah, this was built by Rice Beale After he took over Dr. Chase's empire, he erected this building to rent to the federal government for the post office. And that was kind of handy because one of the clauses of his contract with Dr. Chase stipulated that all mail arriving in Ann Arbor addressed to Dr. Chase should be delivered to one Rice Beal.
Well,
Dr. Chase found this extremely annoying when he came back to town. But it continued for a while at least, and this is where the mail was delivered and where Mr. Beal came to pick up Dr. Chase's letters.
So it lasted as a post office for 27 years, apparently.
Yeah, it was an interesting building, but very crowded on the ground floor where the post office itself was located. Professional offices were rented upstairs. And the students at the university used to love to come down here at night and all run into the building at one time so that the townspeople couldn't get near it to pick up their own mail. This was before home delivery for a few years. I think we finally did get, Susan knows, when did we get home delivery, 1887? I think this was erected in 1880, well, I thought 1883, but 1882 was close enough. And Beal.
Someone has a comment on that.
Oh, well, actually, I had a question whether it was common for bathrooms to be located in post offices in those days.
No, this was not a government building. The post office only rented the ground floor area for the post office activities. Bathrooms were strewn all over Main Street. And this was at a time before running water was necessarily piped into all the homes in town. That didn't start until 1885 when we got our water company privately owned at that time.
One more question here.
People used to go downtown and take a bath. It was a service that was offered by various commercial enterprises.
What's hanging over the street? That couldn't be electrical. What, over on the left-hand side?
Yeah, that's one of the original street lights. This picture is not from 1882. This was...
93.
Yeah, that's right, 93. And... that probably would be from the Van Diepoli company that put in the first electric lights.
Well, there's been a lot of things on this corner. Unfortunately, I don't have any record of the various things that have been there, but now it has this.
Yeah.
And I don't even know who the architect is for this.
Well, you know, we lost that building in 1935 because the Ann Arbor News, which was located right next door, wanted to expand. And so they bought the building and tore it down. And then right after they demolished this wonderful, crocketed, exuberant building, they changed their minds about building the new plant on that site and decided to go over at the corner of Division Street and Huron and demolish the old Presbyterian Church and build on that site. So they were able to demolish two historic structures for the price of one, so
now
to speak.
They've been demolished.
This was a vacant lot for 5 years before a Kroger store went in.
If anybody knows who the architect for this is, they can tell me later, and I'll put it in there sometime. It's a Washtenaw County building now, apparently. Well, this is just a view down south along Main Street from Ann Street. So the buildings that you see are on the west side of Main Street. And I think it's a wonderful picture. And you notice that typically of the 19th century, our cities had a kind of scale about them, which unfortunately today they've lost. You don't really have any west fronts anymore, unless you can say that this one down there is. That's all that's left. Now,
someone was asking before the program started where the Whitney Theater used to be located, and it was that building on the corner there. In this picture, it had a French Second Empire roof on it, but that was later torn off and two more stories were added there. The Playbill leaning against the post outside is for a play called Lost in New York.
And that sat right there once in that parking lot area. Okay, we're going to turn around and look at the county courthouse. I realized by the time I came here as a student in the fall of 49, they had already taken the tower off of this thing. And maybe that's why I didn't remember it.
Yeah, I think that's why people didn't value it as much when it finally was destroyed, that they allowed that to happen. Of course, that was a project, replacing this building with the so-called county building of the 1950s. That was a project pushed very strongly by the five-term mayor of Ann Arbor, William E. Brown, Jr. He was the father of Sherry Brown of the Ann Arbor Art Association. And at a meeting, he's quoted as saying, that building was erected in the 19th century. Need I say more? That was his philosophy of get rid of it.
Well, not only
this is the wonder that we have replacing it.
Not only did we lose the building, but we lost the sense of place because the lawn is gone too. I think it's a really sad thing that happened.
It was very economical. They built the new building around the old one so that they could still keep using the old one until it was time to tear it down, and then that became the parking lot for the new structure. And just before it was demolished, all the records were passed through the windows from the old building to the new, from the county clerk's office and the register of deeds and so forth. And then it came time to say goodbye, and I've heard from Judge Ross Campbell years ago that Judge Brakey, our only circuit judge at the time, was talking with the county clerk, Luella Smith, in her office there on the ground floor of the new building. And they both had the idea at the same instant to see what had happened to the Statue of Justice up there on the cornice, up on the parapet of the old building. And they ran to the window just in time to see the wrecking ball strike her off of her perch. Wasn't even worth saving the Statue of Justice. Some people might say that's kind of symbolic about the situation with government locally anyway.
It may be that, I think it was yesterday, I came across a photograph, I'll bet it was in Susan's book in Lost Ann Arbor, because it was a view of the new building wrapped around the old one, looking down on it, so you saw the roof of the old building without its tower. And I didn't have time to scan it and get it in here, or I'd have included it. But so this is a very sad part of our story. Let's go on to something.
Ralph Jurgenoff, incidentally, was an architect who practiced in Ypsilanti. So this is Ypsilanti's revenge on Ann Arbor.
Oh, dear. All right.
He did some good work, though.
There's the Gregory House. Was it called the Gregory House before it became a Masonic temple?
Yes, it was. That's another thing. You mentioned the Masonic temple. That happened in 1885. The old hotel was the Gregory House, and it was acquired by Beale, Junius Beale.
Wow.
Rice Beale was dead by that time. He died in 1883. Junius Beale took this over. He was a very active Mason, and he converted the upper two floors to the Masonic Hall and various Masonic lodge rooms. And it's interesting to me that Beale is involved in the Dr. Chase building, this building, and the old post office. I'm sure he must have been one of the influential people of Ann Arbor who helped to sponsor this publication.
He certainly ran all of North Main Street, didn't he?
Yeah.
And were they then in the Masonic Temple then until they built the new ill-fated one that was destroyed some years ago?
Yes, they were at this location until about 1924, 25.
That's another sad tale, which is not included in this talk because they don't have a picture of that building in this book. So
too late.
See, we are avoiding other sad stories. Yes.
We have a question over here.
Am I correct in assuming that the Beals that you're speaking of have come down to the J.C. Beal Construction Group, who also own that building that had a big fire in Ypsilanti?
No, I don't think that the present Beals are related. Certainly not very closely related.
Oh.
But it is interesting, now that you mention it, to recall that this building that we're in now is on the site of the Beal home.
The Beal house was dated at 1860, and that was the earliest building in this whole show that I could get a date for. So we'll get to it. Anyway.
This is George Ware's downtown bookstore. He later had, about the same time, he also had a bookstore on State Street. But he's the guy who lived in the Greek Revival temple that you showed the picture of earlier.
Which didn't make the cut.
Actually, he acquired that house in 1893 at a tax sale on the courthouse steps.
At the moment, the Ann Arbor Savings Bank seems to be in the corner of this of the building here. Well, it had a sad history, too. I hate to admit it, but when I was an architecture student here in the early 50s, I thought that was a great idea. I'm embarrassed to say so now. But to cover up all these ugly old buildings with aluminum siding, I thought that was really cool. And I got educated, though. It took a while. And, of course, they covered the whole thing up, even putting, notice the tall piece that goes over the pediment there? Well, then it had a fire somewhere around 71, I think. And you could see for a while the remnants of the old building behind it. But it was so badly damaged that they ended up creating what we call a site leak there at the corner for a while. And then after that, Hobbs and Black got busy and put this in there. I don't have the exact date, but it's in the 90s or 80s or 90s somewhere. Anyway, that's the fate of that particular building. Now we're going down to some odds and ends of Main Street. The Aberball Hardware Company here first. Northeast corner, Main and Washington. This building also went through a series of changes. For some reason, the buildings, though, that are down there with the arches seem to have survived.
Yeah, the Eberbaugh family was an old German family of Ann Arbor. Christian Eberbaugh was the pioneer. He, by coincidence, was the man who translated Dr. Chase's recipe book into the German language. It was also published in a Swedish edition. The Eberbaugh hardware store was only on this side of the corner building. There was the State Savings Bank right on the corner. And then the hardware store wrapped around the bank and came out here. This was the Washington Street entrance of the hardware store.
Oh, so it was quite extensive, wasn't it?
And, of course, the Eberbaughs had a principal business, which was the pharmaceuticals and the manufacture of precision scientific instruments, especially for the use in high school laboratories. And that Eberbaugh building was erected later down the street on Liberty, where the present federal building is now. This corner State Savings Bank building was erected in 1908.
All right.
And there's one of the old open street cars. I think those were called Brills. They were made by the Brill Manufacturing Company. And the idea of having them open-sided like that in the summertime was for cooling. The winter street cars had a central aisle. You'd get on it at one end or the other and go down a central aisle to get your seat. But these open street cars didn't have an aisle. They simply had benches right across the width of the car. And you'd, as that woman is doing there, you'd grab hold of one of the vertical posts and hoist yourself up on the running board and hope you got an opening where there was a place to sit.
These were not for old people, were they, these street cars? What about us old folks? How did we get on?
Maybe they had young boys who would hoist you there.
Okay. This was already powered, wasn't it, electric streetcar by this time, right?
I think the AATA took a lesson from the problem they had with this.
See, then they covered this. They clearly put an addition on this corner building and covered it, because you can still see the window patterns here that are in this building.
That was about 1957, I think.
Oh, okay. I was sort of guessing at some of these dates, because now David Osler has replaced the whole thing with Chase.
And the nice thing about this is that it reflects two much more interesting buildings than that old State Savings Bank, which was not a fine example of architecture, I think we'll agree.
Now, this is looking north from Liberty, again with the streetcar. The street looks unpaved, though, itself. And it's only one line.
Yeah, it wasn't paved with brick until later in the 1890s.
Okay. This is more or less the same place, with Ann Arbor's tallest building having been built in 29, First National Bank. And
that wasn't really a good year for building new banks.
No. Maybe it was early in 29, about the time I was born, and then after that came the crash, you see, in the fall. Well, this is a group of buildings that I feel very proud of, because I helped to save them. The city had bought them in the early 70s and was going to destroy them so that they could enlarge the parking lot that was behind them. And it was at a time when Whiston and Frank and I had done a survey of the central part of Ann Arbor. And we had then not only taken pictures of 700 different buildings, I think it was, but been so audacious as to give them ratings, to say, you know, get them, I think we had four different levels of ratings. And the top one, these showed up on a map, and the black ones were top priority, dark gray was second, light gray third, and then simply blank was fourth. And I think it ended up that the Harbor building on the left came out to be a top one, and the other were in the second category. And so when the city had a hearing about these buildings, and we went with our survey in hand, which had just been published, and we said, look, you can't tear these buildings down. They're in the top two levels here. And they said, yeah, so they are. I mean, of course, we had given them that level, right? But they never bothered to point that out. They just said, okay. And I said, all right, then you should sell these back to private owners and let them fix it up. And by golly, they did. Yeah. I still can hardly believe it.
Of course, we also got the...
thank you.
We got the sesquicentennial celebration to put its headquarters in the Harrer building.
Yes.
Which is now the site of the West Side Bookstore. And Jay Platt back there is the impresario.
Good.
Of that Ann Arbor institution.
Yes, exactly. And the Arcures had the upper floors. And they had on the two, second and third floors, they had wooden shutters inside. There were six windows, and there were two shutters on each side of each window. So there was something like 24 panels of shutter. And I bought these because they were not attached to the building, so they were not part of the building as far as tearing the building down. And I remember taking a deep breath and paying $100 for all these shutters. I remember calling up Mary and saying, I've just spent $100 on wooden shutters, which if this building is destroyed are worthless. But fortunately, Dr. Arcure found out that I had bought these from somewhere, maybe Ray, Jay, but in any case, he got in touch with me and bought them all back, I think for $110. I made a big profit, and by golly, they put them all up. And since he was a dentist, he can even refashioned some of the hinges and stuff and put the all the up again. So that was another triumph. You know, there's, I have this saying in preservation work. Preservation work is usually either defeats or truces, because you can't depend on a victory. But this is about as close to a victory as we've come in this work, along with the fire station.
And right after that, the Ann Arbor Art Association got the Carriage Works building.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable. It's just, do you have some more stuff on these buildings?
Riders was in the middle, Riders Hobby Shop. They moved out finally. They did do a bit of restoration work ultimately on the upper floor and shoveled out about 2 tons of pigeon dung. Pigeons had gotten in through broken windows at the back.
Do you have any background about the Haar and Walker people? Are they?
Yeah, Haar originally, John Haar was a photographer, and his 19th century photographs, the carte de visites and the cabinet photos, show up occasionally for sale at the Treasure Mart and other places. Unfortunately, the people are unidentified. If you have old photos at home, go home now and identify them.
You mean right now?
Right now, yeah.
No. After the show.
Okay. And then, of course, later the family switched to selling books there. There was a horror bookstore years before Jay Platt moved in. And in recent years, as the men who owned the place got very old, there was an insurance office there, but it wasn't doing a whole lot of business. And remember Doug Crary found a chest full of little metal canisters of Haar's Wonder Salve. That apparently was something they sold on the side. Some of them were full. And he sold those, I think, for $1 a piece to raise money for the sesquicentennial celebration back in 1974.
Way back then, that's right.
I think those are probably still available here and there.
Okay.
I see them now and then on eBay.
This is sort of a few of the buildings. It's a source of great delight for me that they're still there, and I think we won't. See, one of the arguments to the city was across the street from this on the north side, you had these six, was that the Shaverly block, for the six ones on the other side?
Shaverly.
Yeah, and I said, there you have those. And I said, for a while here, you have a real sense of a place. I said, if you knock these buildings down, then who knows how long the other ones are going to last. And because this one block is quite good and secure. And so.
You see in the lower left-hand picture, the blue building across the alley from the Haar building. That was where there was a print shop that printed all the U of M football tickets. So they had to paint the brick blue, you know, to show their loyalty. Frank.
King, I don't know if you were involved, but the building, the upper right photo, the building which faces on Main Street, which has those are false windows.
Up in here.
Right. At one point there was a fitness club up there. I don't think it's there anymore. And we had to negotiate with the fellow from West Bloomfield, a fellow by the name of Pete Vestovich. I got to know him later in my university days. And we had to arm wrestle down at city council to talk him into, you know, just putting false windows in there and just instead of just bricking up the whole side of that building to put his. And so I feel good about those false windows, too.
Good for you. All right. Okay. This is another happy story, I think. How about it, Winston?
Yeah. Yeah, you and I were involved in saving this one, too, putting out propaganda for the cause. I remember you even put a video together that you showed at City Council.
Well, yeah, it was a 1 3-minute Super 8 film taken driving from over at the east end of Huron. I think the 3 minutes actually got me all the way down under the railroad bridge west of Main Street when it ran out. But it was enough to show you that if you drive along there, this was the only really interesting building you saw. And then, of course, what's her name who lived down there on on Fuller came in with her school kids. I'll think of her name. His names go first, by the way. She brought in a whole bevy of school kids with signs into this meeting of the council where we showed the movie, saying, "Save our firehouse," and they climbed all over the desks and everything. And I can't think of who it was. Anyway, yes, Nan Hodges, thank you. And so we saved it, and I think that it came out pretty well because Fry and Peters did a rather tasteful addition to it. And I remember talking to the chief, at the time was named Schmidt, I think. And I said, I had in mind, chief, that you could take the upper level of this old building and put your office in it. Well, that upper level, I think, had been the dormitories for the firemen. And I think Chief Schmidt could not take himself beyond the smell of dirty socks and this atmosphere in that room and an office in that place, I think he thought to himself. Because he didn't respond very much to it, and he ended up getting a little faraway office out in the far corner. But anyway, the building is there, and that means that it's being used, of course, now as a hands-on museum, but it could someday have offices up there, and then they could put the small cars in the front. I still have that in my mind.
Cynthia Yao is here in the second row today, and she had the idea of putting the hands-on museum in the building there.
I think it was a great idea.
The first director of it.
I guess I'm thinking of some time when the collection gets so enormous they have to have a new building, and then we can put the chief up there on the second floor. But at least it's still there. See, it was painted once, as you see, and I remember that Dick Fry talked about it wasn't clear whether they're going to take the paint off or not, so he tried to pick a brick color that would go with either painted or unpainted, but then they took the paint off. It looks really fine today, I think. It's a handsome building.
Can you back up to the big picture?
Pardon?
Back up to the big picture.
Okay. Yes.
A lot of people don't realize that there's some symbolism up here in these window arches. The helmet that was the badge of authority for the supervisor of the fire department to issue orders at fires. This was back when we had a volunteer fire department still. And there's also, I think, some, I don't see it here, but some cross speaking trumpets. Those were used to issue orders at the fires, at the fire scene. Civilians were expected to pitch in and pass the buckets along in the bucket brigade.
I guess you all realize that these towers were not just ornament, but they were used for a couple of things. One is they dried hoses in them by hanging them down in the middle of it, and the other is they used them for climbing ladder practice. And this one is very Italianate. This top of this is a bit like Florence or Siena's old city hall. And so it's a very, very fine example of this kind of Italianate revival. It's beautiful. Okay. Now we're moving slightly eastward. We're working our way over towards State Street.
Looking north here at the corner of Washington Street, looking up South 4th Avenue, north.
Is it an avenue, actually?
4th Avenue, yep.
Oh, sorry.
You're thinking of the Old West Side.
I'll fix it for next time.
There's a cow up there on the weather vane.
A cow?
Yeah, and it got restored. Oops. Somebody found another cow a few years ago, and it's
well,
up there.
Let's go on and see if we see it. This is the.
It was gone at this time.
Okay, this is the first restoration, shall we say?
There was a hippie a place there called the Dragon Inn. That's where it got all the vibrant LSD color scheme.
But there was also in there a Army surplus store, wasn't there?
That came right afterwards.
Afterwards, all right. Well, now it's not looking too bad, at least a year or two ago.
In the 1960s, it was a fairly respectable joint called Martin's Gems and Minerals. Oh. You could go in there and get your rocks off.
Well, I think this is another nice piece of work. It's ended up as a nice job, huh? I'll say this is also a...
In the background there, one block north, you see the tower of the firehouse?
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. there. This has been a very useful photograph because I think I'm right that this photograph was used to restore the cornice to the corner building, right? Probably. Because it...
Yeah, I imagine so.
Because the 1868 building lost its cornice for many years, as you see.
Yeah, that's right.
Here.
And the Weinman block, the left-hand portion, was pressed metal, which I think was a product of the Detroit Cornice and Slate Company.
Yes.
We also had another pressed metal facade one block west on the corner of 4th Avenue. This is the corner of 5th Avenue in Washington.
But that one's gone, right?
That one's gone, yeah. There are still some pressed metal facades on State Street from 1890.
Oh. Why haven't we talked about this before?
Well, I was waiting until you were old enough.
All right. That'll do. Oh, yes.
I wasn't aware that it was a secret.
Well, for me it was, apparently. There's another sad story, isn't it?
That's the one that the Ann Arbor News tore down when they built in 1935. But the Presbyterians didn't want the building anymore. They built their new building on Washington Avenue in 1935.
So this happened to it.
And that's an Albert Kahn building. That, unfortunately, it's been mutilated a bit on the outside when they got rid of the original fenestration.
For a while, I thought it was by Walter Anika. Why did I think that?
I don't know.
Okay, but I've corrected it since the last time we met.
I used to be in grade school with his daughter, Walter Anika's daughter, Virginia, Burns Park School.
Oh, goodness.
A little while ago.
Look into this some more. Okay, well, this is another sad story. I shouldn't be editorializing, but I don't understand why Ann Arbor can't have a daily paper. I think it's a scandal. Thank you. I'm fed.
It's the advertising is the problem.
Yeah.
They weren't getting enough advertising to support it. Yeah. I'm sure everybody in town would be glad to subscribe if it were still around.
Now, here we are, right on this site.
That should have an apostrophe after the L.
Oh, good. Okay, sorry. You know, it's too bad I can't repair these right here.
You need a different clicker.
Right. But I think 1860, I think, was the year for this house. And as I said earlier, I think this is the earliest date that we see any building identified. And I think that maybe these people putting put the book together said that other stuff was simply out of date. We want modern Ann Arbor, they said in 1893, right?
Yep. Beale's, I guess, granddaughter decided to tear it down. Her mother was still living at the time. And we're talking about Junius Beale's granddaughter. And she said that the family couldn't bear the idea of anyone else living in their house. It was kind of a family shrine, and that's why that isn't there anymore, and we have the library here instead.
So we may be standing over the very foundations right at this very moment.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere back in there, right?
Actually, we're down in the basement of that house.
Was it on the corner or sort of back? In other words,
if you look at the picture there, it looks awfully close to William Street.
In other words, it was somewhere in here, probably, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, right. This is fun. It turns out that their picture of St. Thomas the Apostle is not of the church because the church was built later than the book, but of the school. And I finally found a picture that showed that it's on, I think, Elizabeth Street. That runs parallel to the state, right? This north-south street.
Isn't there a Z in Elizabeth?
Pardon?
A Z?
Is there a Z or an S? Is it a Z?
It's the German spelling.
With a Z, right?
Yes.
Okay, sorry about that. This thing is fraught with mistakes.
We have to do this. We have to do this show more often.
Yeah, you should.
Got to keep track of you. I think you're changing the captions from year to year.
Yes.
We haven't done this show since a year ago.
That's right. They'll be sorry that ever filmed this. Okay. Anyway, there's another picture, see, that I discovered. And by golly, this is on State Street, but there's the school, you see. So it's on the was on the west side of Elizabeth Street, apparently. Next to maybe that was the parish house there, perhaps, or something. And then another building across from it, part of the school. So my picture here is looking up. It would have been around there, I suppose.
Yeah, I think the school was down behind the church.
Yes, to the right, in other words, off the, to the right, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a wonderful church, but it's too new for our show.
Actually, The school was where the present school is.
And here's another one of their marvelous pictures taken. They have a few of them like this, where you can't see anything of the building.
Well, they should have taken that one in January.
Right. You know, if they were doing 64 books, they had to stay on the move.
I think they were taking pictures from month to month.
Yeah, probably.
Because a lot of these are seasonal as you go along through the year.
Yeah, and then you have to house your horses somewhere, right?
I think you should recaption all of these pictures with the month that they appeared. It might be significant.
Yeah, but would we know that the pictures were taken that month?
I'll tell you what we do know.
Right. What do we know?
This block of Catherine Street didn't exist in 1893. The street goes right along there now. Of course, it goes the other way, one-way street.
Well, we do have pictures of it without the tree. There's one I took many years ago.
There's the street.
By the way, I put this question, you know, they've been working on the front of that for months. They're done now. But what were they doing? The roof?
Yeah. Roof. Roof, roof.
But they seem to cover the whole entranceway with this stuff. Anyway, it's a beautiful building, and
the tower was added in 1903. A gift from Dr. Alonzo Palmer's widow, Love Root Palmer.
Oh, that's great.
In her will, completing the original plan that, at least according to all hearsay I've heard, that. The church wanted a tower originally, but they couldn't afford it, so they waited until she died and added it then.
But do you suppose that Gordon Lloyd had designed the church with this tower as part of the design?
I think that may be the case. I'm not sure. I've never seen a picture of the original design.
Because this was going on in Europe too. In 1880, the city of Cologne completed their cathedral, which had not been under construction since the 16th century, and then 1890, the city of Ulm completed the tower of their Munster from original drawings also, and that had been sitting since 1543 without anything going on. And so this is all part of this completion of Gothic edifices, right?
I climbed to the very pinnacle of the Ulm Tower
in
1956, something I could never do again.
I think that
the tallest cathedral tower in Europe.
Yes, I think Mary and I climbed it in 57.
No.
My golly,
all
right.
You see my initials? I scratched them at every at every level.
I'll look next time.
All right.
Okay. Oh, here's another happy story, Whiston.
Yeah, Hobart. It was designed for the Episcopal students at the university, and therefore it was sponsored not just by the local Episcopal congregation, but theoretically by the entire state. And one of the people who really helped to raise funds for this project was Bishop Harris, and it was for the Hobart League of the Episcopal Student Organization. And Harris died right after the funds were gathered. And so they said, hey, let's name it after him. So it's been Harris Hall ever since then. I think it was called Hobart Hall only for about a year.
And we have a hang on just a moment. We got a question right over here.
thank you. I note that you have noted the School of Music was there until 1946 and then moved to the new building. But I recall a building where the Maynard Street entrance is to the old Jacobson's that was, you could hear the strains of the School of Music coming from the basement.
Yeah, I don't know why you call it School of Music here at Kingsbury. School of Music at the university did also use this building. They rented it, but it wasn't their building.
Oh, but all right. Did they have the building that was across the left, across here on the south?
The School of Music was on Maynard Street until the Burton Tower, okay, at least, was opened in 1936.
Pardon?
Yeah, the band was in here.
Well, the band was in there. All right, I'll fix that.
Including the marching band. William Ravelli had his office in there. And in the summer of, 1955 or so, I and a bunch of kids were recruited to learn how to play clarinet under his supervision. He came in there scowling once a week, and he had a terrifying glint in his eye. Of course, I couldn't read music. I don't know what I was doing in there in the first place. I didn't last very long.
All right, but the building has lasted.
I couldn't keep my reed wet.
Question here?
I just wanted to comment. I think at this very moment, the School of Music opposite the library entrance on the third floor up there, at the new School of Music, has a display of the history with photographs of the School of Music. I hope it's still there.
Winston, we'll have to go over these so the next time we do this, it'll be right.
Yeah, right.
See, it went from having trees to no trees, having trees again. So, and this one is pinned down by the fact that they're building the inn there.
Advertising company in there for quite a while.
Oh, okay. Good. Anyway, yeah. it's looking grand now.
Yeah, the Campus Inn was built in the 1960s.
Okay, here we come to Sackett Hall and the old church. Is this Sackett Hall here, Winston?
Yeah, the house on the corner. That was the residence of Ezra C. Seaman, S-E-A-M-A-N, who was the founder and the leader of the Ann Arbor Scientific Association. They even put out an annual report at least once. And he also wrote books, very weighty, learned tomes, which you can Google. You can read them on Google Books nowadays. But he wasn't connected with the university. He was apparently independently wealthy and just pursued his intellectual habits. And when he died, that house went to his daughter, whose name was Sackett. Forgotten what her first name was. But that's how it became Sackett Hall instead of Seaman Hall. And then right behind it, Senator James McMillan of Michigan gave the funds to erect McMillan Hall, which was for the U of M students of the Presbyterian persuasion. And that was combined. There was a kind of a breezeway between the two buildings.
You mean right here, this one.
Where is it? Oh, I'm sorry. This is State Street looking south at the corner of Huron Street.
Sorry, I should have put it
the
up.
The spire there is of the Methodist Church. And eventually, when the Presbyterians decided to leave their place where the Ann Arbor News is now in 1935, they moved over to Washtenaw Avenue, and they wanted to raise money for that project, so they sold Sackett Hall and McMillan Hall to the Methodists. And that really got a lot of Presbyterians in the state excited that they would sell Presbyterian buildings to Methodists.
And this is what then
luckily
happened.
The old Methodist church was torn down in 1940 because the brick wall facing Washington Street was about to buckle, apparently. Oh. So they got rid of it, and it got very handy to have those other buildings, which they could use, tear those down too, of course, but they could use the land for the new Methodist church.
I think I knew sometime who the architect, but I can't remember. Fry and Catherine. Oh, the same ones. All right, thank you. It'll be up there next time. And here's another a very fine photograph of the Ann Arbor High School. Also of...
I'm not sure the town library was in there at that time, and that was the later high school. Okay. This one burned down on the last day of 1904. The original portion at the right was built in 1856, and the left portion in 1889 with a stone tower, but of course the trees won't let you see the tower.
Check that.
The whole thing burned down on the last day of 1904. That's the same year that the Ann Arbor Railroad trestle collapsed on Argo Pond. It's also the same year that the flouring mill on Broadway exploded and burned to the ground.
Not a good year.
An interesting year.
Well,
may you live in interesting times.
Yes. Unfortunately, I don't seem to have taken a slide of the front of the old Ann Arbor High School. Maybe, but I can't find
it. The Freeze Building?
Yeah, the Freeze Building.
Yeah.
So what we've got to show you, unfortunately, is just this new Robert A.M. Stern thing. This I took a year ago, and I just went out on, as you see, on 3 days ago and took this. I'm not sure it's better than that one, but there it is.
Considering your great enthusiasm for the architecture of Robert A.M. Stern, I don't think it makes much difference.
Okay. Okay, let's go. Let's go on.
Yeah, here's the other bookstore for George War or Var on State Street. It wasn't always in that archway. It later got moved down to where the Red Hawk is now. But in 1893, it was located in the archway of that rather handsome building. The odd thing about that building, to me, is the way that the buttresses here came out into the public right-of-way, and they're not there anymore. And I've always wondered whether they got shaved off and flattened for modernization purposes in the 1920s, or whether the city said, look, you can't do that. It violates the zoning code. Because I can imagine blind people or drunks bumping into them.
And tripping over them.
Yeah, doing a bit of damage to their face and so forth.
But it's a wonderful building.
You see how it's been flattened there now. And I think that happened probably in the 1920s. And it looks like it might be Pewabic tile that was placed there. For a long time, both sides were Marty's menswear. A lot of people remember that.
Winston is often... troubled me that they redid the top. Notice this is all brick. This is not some applied cornice. This is brick, but for some reason they took it apart and did this to it. Maybe it was needed some pointing.
Yeah, it weren't pointed properly. It could be the bricks came loose and started to fall on people.
But there's something else interesting about it. Notice these wonderful windows, these bay windows, enclosed in these arches. Well, when I was teaching architectural history, I discovered that Frank Lloyd Wright, I remembered in years after that he had designed a house in River Forest in which he had done the same kind of windows up on the roof. You see, they're in an arch and they're also bay windows. And to find out who copied whom, I found the date, and lo and behold, Frank Lloyd Wright must have copied them from this building, right? Another question back here, or comment. I think it's a great design, and I'm glad to see it still there.
That last picture, looking south on State Street, featured, I believe, the buildings that have tin fronts that you referred to earlier.
Oh, yes, huh?
Oh, you mean these down in here?
Yep, the university block and the office block.
Oh.
Okay. You see the six storefronts there in a row just north of the brick one?
South of them.
Yeah. Now, as you see, a lot of them several of them have been lost. I think there are still three left. Mm-hmm. The first one was lost in 1935 during a terrible fire at the McLean and Nealon's grocery store.
I think it's great they're still there, and maybe other benefactors will come back.
Might be worth pointing out that those buildings were not built all together. That the buildings existed there before the press metal facades were put on to kind of unify them. Mm-hmm. And that was done in 1890, but the buildings are of various ages.
When was the arcade put in?
1916.
Yeah, during the First World War, right? Yeah.
Except that we weren't in that war yet.
Right. I think maybe the photographer for this didn't like Gordon Lloyd because he keeps covering up his buildings, but we do have pictures of it without the trees.
A centennial building. Finished in 1876. That year was expected to give a special cachet to any project, from a patriotic standpoint, at least.
Right.
Maybe not an architectural one.
Another one. University Hall.
With the original tower. They had a problem with that tower, the same as the county of Washtenaw had with the tower of the old county courthouse, apparently. Was regarded as too heavy to be supported any longer by the structure below it. So they took the old tower off, I think it was cast iron or something like that, and replaced it with a wooden one much lower in 1896.
I wonder if this Jennison is the same one who kept a marvelous scrapbook of the building of the state capitol in Lansing, because I did research when I gave a report on the Capitol some years ago with Dick Frank to try to save the Capitol, which we did, of course. This was very, very useful. It's in the state archives in Lansing, and I'm sure his name was Jennison, who had kept this book. And I wonder if it may be the same person.
If you go in the basement of Angel Hall today, you can see the cornerstone of this building with Jennison's name on it.
Down in here.
Do you have a picture of that?
Sorry. Not yet. Not yet. Tomorrow.
You'll do what you can, right?
What I can, right. So then Albert Kahn took this and wiped it across the front. And
yeah, he built Angel Hall about 10 feet in front of University Hall, the ultimate insult to an architectural forebear.
That's right. There's a picture that I should find that and scan it and get it in there, where you're looking along the back of Angel Hall and you see the two of them almost touching each other.
Yeah. I'm surprised the students didn't swing them from one to the other on ropes or something.
Right across the street is this beautiful building by Spear and Roan, Newberry Hall.
I think I've heard that there's Indiana bluestone there and somebody else's limestone.
What, was it built by the Student Christian Association, Weston?
Yes. Yeah, they had a reading room on the ground floor, and on the upper floor was a big auditorium with a huge stained glass window by Tiffany, which has also been restored. You know, they had trouble raising the funds to build this. They had it partly completed and couldn't finish it with what they had on hand. So they had an exhibition in 1891 of antiques donated or lent, rather, by Ann Arbor householders. And those items were placed on display in the finished portion of Newberry Hall. And the public came in and gave donations or bought tickets to see all the goodies. And that helped them raise money to finish the, I don't know what part wasn't done yet, but there are reports of this in the newspapers of 1891. One of the items, the central item on display at that time, is an artifact that now belongs to the Washtenaw County Historical Society. It's Lucy Chapin's piano. And this was apparently the first public exhibition of that piano, was in Newberry Hall in 1891.
Wow.
It was made in 1815 in New York. was the first piano west of Detroit in Michigan Territory.
Well, this is
it's now out at the Stearns Collection of Musical Instruments. But I don't think they have it displayed currently.
So this is a beautiful building. It's wonderful this has survived, too. Here's another story with not such a happy ending. William LeBaron Jenney came here in 1876, and for 1 year, we had an architectural program. And I think it was under the Department of Mines or something like that. But they only gave him money for 1 year, and then after that year, they didn't give him any more, so he went back to Chicago and invented the skyscraper, which is a different talk. But he had done this university museum while he was here.
And he apparently commuted week to week from Chicago to Ann Arbor to meet his classes. Two of his pupils lived right across the street from this building, actually.
Oh.
Why am I blanking on their name? Pond. Pond and Pond.
The Pond Brothers, yes.
Yeah, the Pond Brothers, who designed the Michigan Union on the site of their boyhood home, and the Michigan League for Women kind of balanced the scales. Michigan Union was strictly for men at first.
Well, in other words, they lived there.
They practiced in Chicago. They followed their mentor to Chicago after learning the trade from him in 1879.
And then Robert A.M. Stern followed them. Because his stuff is kind of warmed over Pond Brothers.
Does he doff his hat to them?
Maybe.
Oh, you mean the stuff?
Yeah, the stuff he's doing.
Yeah, what he's doing to Ann Arbor.
Yeah, right.
Here we have a question right over here.
I just wonder, where was it? Where was this building?
Sorry, this is the University Museum, later known as the Romance Language Building, and it was on the site of the present new addition to the University Museum of Art.
Is this about right that it was destroyed in 1957?
57, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Are you going to tell about the Deke Shant and the fact that it had an elevator in it, which was invented, one of LeBaron Jenney's innovations, and which was so important in building skyscrapers?
Oh, that's a good idea. Why don't you tell people about that, Mary?
I'll just give the mic to you.
They know more about it than
this I is do. My sister, Mary Hathaway. We have another sister named Grace Termott, who lives near Minneapolis and who had an office in this building before it was torn down when she worked as a secretary in the Romance Language Department.
But unfortunately, the people who put this book together didn't like the Deke Shant. I don't understand why, because that even fell within the second half of the century. They should have included it, but they didn't. So, see, we're constricted by this. We're going to have to do another talk someday that does all the other stuff.
We have to trace the history of the politics of this book.
Right.
Why certain buildings were included and not others.
Right.
Why certain churches, for example, and not others.
That's right. Well, that's sort of what's there now, folks, where this, it stood right in there, right?
Right where the big rectangle is.
Okay. Sort of around the corner now. This Van Brunt, by the way, was one of the important architects for the 1893 fair. In fact, he was brought in by Burnham and Root, who were the first people to start designing the fair, to act as a consultant group. And Van Brunt ended up designing one of the big buildings for the fair. I can't remember which, but one of the huge ones that was on this central lagoon. But, as you see, before that, he did our library. And for a long time, I knew that when they destroyed this library to build the new one, that they had saved the stacks. But this was the only picture I'd ever seen. And that is not the stacks, but it must be a reading room.
That's
there,
the reading room.
Which is facing north, apse. I think, right?
The apse was entered from either side. This is one of the entrances, and I'm not sure whether this was the women's entrance or the men's. But there were separate entrances. Women sat on one side of the reading room, men on the other.
Really?
And up above the reading room was the art gallery. And wrapped around the art gallery was something called the Whispering Gallery. It was just a corridor. And people would bring anyone newly arrived in town up here and stand at one end of this curved gallery and whisper a message, and it could be heard by somebody at the other end.
Before
this was one of the great huge attractions of Ann Arbor before the Michigan Theater.
Yeah, and before the invention of the cell phone. By golly. All right. Well, see, I came across this other picture and realized that those are the stacks that they saved there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. It all fits together now. But it only took me about 75 years to find this other picture. I think it was a great building. We lost some really nice buildings because
the
that must have been a wonderful.
The stacks that you see there were later extended back, too.
Yeah, I mean these.
Yeah. Yeah. At least the lower portion of it.
Then, of course, once again, Kahn puts a building that wipes it all out. But it's of course, this has a wonderful space in it, too, his library. As you may know, the Bentley now is getting all of the Kahn archives. So,
you know what happened to the towers of the old library?
What?
Most beloved building on campus. Some of the structure underneath was removed gingerly, and then it was braced short up with timbers, and these were ignited, and the tower collapsed. And there is a sequence of three famous photographs showing the tower collapsing. You got to get that in here before
where
we,
are the
before
three
we do this
famous
show again.
Photographs, Winston?
I'm sure the Bentley has them.
All right. All right. This is another kind of sad story.
Where's the first? Well, this is the 1893 thing, huh?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I kind of like it myself.
Oh, I do too. In fact, I like very much this top of. In fact, I found two recently to make a copy to put in here. But there's a German memorial somewhere along the Rhine or
I
something.
I thought I'd seen postcards or something.
That has
like
a tower
that.
Very much like that.
Yeah.
It has a cylindrical piece set within these four corners, but much bigger than this, but the same idea.
The drum tower.
And for some reason, they built the building, you see, in 63, added the tower in 93, and then took it off again in 98.
Yeah, this is probably the best picture we have of that very brief evanescence, that five-year interval where it looked like that. But apparently, people thought it was so ugly. These were Victorians. I mean, how do Victorians know what an ugly building looks like? But they hated it so much that after it was only up there for 5 years, that tower got knocked off again, and the building was redesigned. My dad had his office in Haven Hall after it was no longer the law building.
Maybe they were Germans, and they said, you have no business copying our famous monument to Bismarck or Wilhelm or whoever. You must be aroused. It must be gone. You are stealing our design. Maybe that's it. We have to look into this, don't we?
Yeah, I think there's a story there.
Okay. Well,
if not, we can make one up.
Exactly, right. Well, these new buildings are not in the same place the old one was. This was up at the northwest corner, wasn't it, of
yeah, there's nothing there. Nothing got built there after the fire. The biggest fire in Ann Arbor's history was the burning of Haven Hall, June 6, 1950. That was the law building, torched by an arsonist.
Not me. I was here, but I didn't do it.
I was here.
Yeah.
I actually saw that fire.
You saw the fire itself?
Yeah. My dad came home and got me and my little sister and took us down to watch the fire. My oldest sister was already watching there. I think she was in high school at the time. Mary, where were you? You saw it too, huh? Yeah.
Was it at night?
No, it was in the afternoon.
The afternoon. I must have been asleep in my Jefferson.
There was one point house. where an entire wall of bricks came crashing down with a huge thundering, rumbling roar, and everybody started to applaud. It was like when a train goes by the Gandhi dancer when people are eating.
But those people applauding were not the same people who lost their life's work in that building.
No. These were students who just liked a big noise. We were standing in the yard of the Congregational Church.
Well, this is the engineering laboratory, which I think...
You don't have a picture of Haven Hall after...
Sorry.
The one that burned?
I'll dig some out.
Yeah, get busy here.
Okay. Didn't this have an auditorium in it, this building? A wooden semicircular auditorium? I think so.
No, I think you're thinking of the West Physics Building.
All right. Okay, that's right.
I have a comment.
Good.
I took pictures of the Haven Hall fire. If you'd like them, I'd email them to you.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Please contact us after this is over.
Sure.
If you haven't left in disgust before we're done.
okay. Never.
it's getting there.
Another question here.
Okay.
Where is this building located? Why aren't any of these labeled where they are?
This is where the ugly is now.
Yes. This will be repaired, so come to the next show.
The not-so-ugly now.
It's just where it's right was there, isn't it, right, where that was?
Yeah, if we could move these slides a little quicker, we'd answer your question before you need to ask them.
Maybe. Anyway, okay. Well, this was at the northeast corner of the great square, at the northeast corner of the sort of secondary diag, you could call it, which has been broken up by this new museum. And this, of course, was just the Waterman. This is, I think, before they put the addition on it, right?
Yeah, but the addition went on the north side there, on this North University Avenue side, and that was Barber Gymnasium for Women. Incidentally, when Waterman was first erected, the architect had installed in this great entablature an inscription in Greek. And the regents decided, no, we didn't allow that. We want English. Tear it off. They had to take the entire slabs of stone off and put in one that simply said Waterman Gymnasium. And they didn't leave any indication in the regent's minutes of what that Greek inscription said. But apparently it was so disgusting that they couldn't leave it there.
Really? Oh, you mean something was put over on them by some Greek stoneworker, right?
I'm sure it was some kind of classical thing. But they said, it said something about, so he who runs may read it. They wanted it clearer, because...
And they didn't keep the old...
Not all the students were classically oriented in those days.
And they didn't keep the old stones either, right?
I've never seen a picture of that Greek inscription. Be nice to find one.
Well, wasn't there a zoo, as I recall, outside of Waterman?
No, the zoo was outside where the University Museum is now, where they built the parking lot.
My mistake.
In the 1960s.
See, but Hartley, Ellington, and Day did something, I think, very nicely. They extended the diag northeast through this building, so that works very nicely, at least. But otherwise...
Yeah, we had a big cause celeb in 1977 trying to save the gymnasium. I went to the regents' meeting with a slideshow showing all the ornate oak woodwork inside, and as soon as I was done with my tearful presentation, my great emotional soliloquy, they turned the lights back on, and Robin Fleming said, well, you see all that woodwork, that's why we have to tear it down. It's a big fire hazard.
Right. Tell us about this. You were talking about these buildings. We saw them in the first slide, you think, right?
Yeah, these are the same buildings that you saw from the other side of the river. I don't know which is which here, but they ended up with about five buildings in a row.
Were they more or less where that building was, or down the street a bit?
No, they were on Catherine Street.
But isn't that Catherine that goes off to the left? That's the... Yeah.
Is that Catherine there?
No, they were on. We're on this.
That says Medical Center Drive.
Yeah, but that's going off to the right. The next one is Catherine, I think, going to the left, right? Correct?
No, that's Ann Street.
Ann Street. Oh, all right.
This is the brand new building that replaced the old University Hospital.
I got to take some more pictures.
No, Catherine Street is where the Taubman Medical Library is now.
Okay.
Right across from Angelo's.
Oh. They had
five original hospital buildings there.
Okay. But then there's that other building that's sort of stuck in there, sort of overcome by this pedestrian bridge that's in front of it. This brick, orange brick.
Yeah. Victor Vaughn Dormitory.
But then to the right of that is where these would have been, right? Okay.
Yep.
This is all going to be much better.
I think the Victor Vaughn Dormitory replaced one of those hospital buildings that burned.
This building, the Church of Christ, has a wonderful history, which Whiston probably knows. How did it happen to get moved?
It was erected in 1890-91.
Right.
And here we see it a couple of years later at the corner of South University Avenue and Haven, I believe. State? No, it wasn't on State. State was the Psi Upsilon fraternity house. It was a little farther east on South U, and I think it was at the corner of Haven Street. Anyway, it looked like this, with the apse as it is and the tower at this side of the apse. And then it got moved when they wanted the land for the law school building. And the university bought the land and paid for dismantling it, actually, and rebuilding it in reverse on the corner of Tappan and Hill Street.
I think that's great.
Now we have the tower at the other side of the apse. I think it was dismantled stone by stone and rebuilt. An enormous project.
We don't have an architect for this building. If anybody knows, let me know when we're done. We're getting close here. See, these buildings were probably considered really modern by the book people who made the book.
Well, I must say I love this old house. It later became a fraternity house. And it looks like a great summer resort place. It should be up on Mackinac Island.
It is beautiful.
And it got modified, I think, after a fire in the 1920s or 30s. And then, of course, it fell into decline as a fraternity house. And I think the fraternity couldn't afford it anymore. And they moved out, and people broke in there and started a fire.
And then
we got Jerry Ford's monument.
Yes.
The Ford School of Public Policy.
Right.
But you got to get a picture of the interim building, too.
Yes, I should tell you that. See, here we're getting this warmed over Pond Brothers, as you now see on the other building up the street.
This is the same guy who did the North Quad.
Right. This is a gem, this Eberball House. Oh, Christian, you were talking about Christian, weren't you?
Yes, Christian Eberbaugh owned the Eberbaugh Hardware Store. His son actually was operating it in 1893. Christian Eberbaugh died in 1901. He died in this house, which is on Woodlawn. Woodlawn actually was the name of the house when it was built.
Oh.
And Woodlawn Avenue that's there now was simply the driveway to this magnificent estate, which backed up to the county fairgrounds. And Christian Eberbaugh died there in 1901 in September. And his physician took pity on the man suffering the agonies of cancer. And he said, "I wish that there were some way that I could take your pain unto me." And Eberbaugh replied quickly, "Doctor, I wouldn't wish this pain on anyone." And then he thought a moment and said, "Except that rascal Czolgosz." And he was referring to the man who had assassinated President McKinley only a week or two earlier. I think I'm not sure when Czolgosz was hanged, but it wasn't very long after Christian Eberbaugh died there in 1901.
Christian, you're You're a wonder. We are. Oh, we're getting close to the end.
I just read the old newspapers. They're full of wonderful gossip.
This is what the Michigan Central Depot.
There's no newspaper now. I might as well read the old ones, right?
You know, this building, the main building in the center, and then the baggage room, I guess this was the baggage room, and then the other building was the express building, something, right?
Yep, the Railway Express Agency, REA.
You know, I got in a big argument with the preservation people back when Chuck Muir bought this. They didn't want him to do anything with it. But in order to make it really viable, he needed a bigger kitchen and some more space. So I was we split up into what I called purists and traitors, and I was one of the traitors. Because I thought you can't keep every building as a museum, but I think that I helped improve it. For example, Chuck was going to make a solid wall along this where he filled in that canopy with a few little windows in it. And I said, Chuck, why don't you just make the whole thing glass so you can see the trains by? And so he did that, and I think that that improved it.
Kingsbury.
It made it lighter than it would have been. Yes.
I remember that conversation well. Chuck Muir had the idea, well, you know, the old wood siding on the railroad cars, we're going
right.
to imitate that.
Gordon Batten.
And I think you and Rick Newman talked him out of that idea.
Yeah, and I think we actually,
betterment of the
I think we actually
building.
Improved this side too, because he had originally wanted to build this here all out of this same stone. And I said, Chuck, it's never going to, no, on the rendering that his architect had done, it looked all the same. But I said, it's not going to look the same. I said, why don't you put something else in, like metal? And I said, it'll save you a lot of money, too. And so he did it, and I think this is much better than it would have been had he made this all out of the same stone. I think it means that this building is more independent of this addition than it would have been. So I think all in all, it's not bad.
Back up to your previous slide. I have to chide you here. Muir is spelled M-U-E-R.
Really? Oh, right.
Why couldn't they build it with stone to match the old stone? Didn't that come right out of Barton Pond?
Yeah, well, maybe it would have.
Isn't that Barton Pond was a stone quarry before the dam, right?
Yeah, maybe they could have.
We should mention also that Chuck Muir died a few years after this great controversy in a very romantic fashion. He just disappeared during a hurricane in the Bermuda Triangle.
I'll bet he didn't think it was romantic those last few minutes.
No, I don't suppose.
Right.
He sailed off one day.
Well, that appropriately brings us to almost the last stop here. Forest Hill Cemetery Gate. This has always been a very favorite building of mine.
This was before the office building at the left was doubled in size.
Oh, that's right. Yep. As you see in these last two here. But otherwise, it stood up very well. And now, of course, it's this. I have a couple of pictures from the book, which are reproduced here. And Wisson.
Angel up there is on the grave of Johnny Berg, who was 13 years old on June 10th, 1887, when he got up early in the morning to see the circus train come to town and unload. He and his buddies were going to meet at dawn down on Depot Street where the train came to a stop, and apparently it was moving so slowly that he actually had his hand on one of the cars and was maybe looking inside to see the animals. The newspaper reports weren't that specific, but it did mention rather graphically that Johnny tripped and fell. He didn't notice the pile of ashes beside the tracks as he was walking along beside the train. And he tripped and fell, and one of his legs landed on the rail and was run over by several successive cars, and in the journalistic terminology of 1887, it was mashed to a jelly.
Oh, dear.
That must have made his mother feel real good to read those words in the paper. She was so ill at the time that she wasn't even able to attend his funeral a day or so later. Very tragic affair with his little friends carrying the tiny casket out here to the grave, which is right near the front entrance of the cemetery.
This is much farther eastward in the cemetery. It was very hard finding this one, but I finally did, because the juxtaposition of these three monuments was unmistakable once you found it.
Yeah, and there's no telling why this monument got in there, because it's nothing special, except that probably they paid for the insertion of the photograph.
The next to the last slide, there is Whiston giving his famous talks. I don't know what year that's from, but there you are. And I pointed this out. This area right here is just inside the gate. This is where Marion and I are going sometime. Not soon, I hope, but right in here. And so after that, you've got to start your tours right here, you know, and tell how you were inspired by your old and now deceased friend Kingsbury. And then everybody will take off their hats.
I want an elaborate monument there with video and all the trimmings.
Right, exactly. So there we are.
Incidentally, that last picture shows King in Copenhagen.
Yes.
The man gets around.
On my 80th birthday, in May 27th of last year. And that's Whiston in October, as you can tell. Yes. Susan.
I just wanted to comment that the bricks from the First Presbyterian Church, when it was demolished, were reused for the Greek Orthodox Church that's now half demolished on North Main Street.
Oh, that's right.
So the bricks in that church are from the 1860s.
And some of those bricks stand in the house on Forest Avenue between Wells Street and Granger.
Oh, how interesting.
And probably other places, too.
Thank you so much for coming to this. I'm sure if you have questions and want autographs, that Whiston and I will be available.